Good evening. In the news tonight, more than 500 crowd Union Square to celebrate International Workers' Day. An estimated 30,000 marched through Manhattan streets demanding an end to nuclear weapons, and despite rain, several hundred irate community activists attend a Saturday protests against ACS drug trials conducted on thousands of Black and Latino foster children. With these and other stories, I'm Sally O'Brien with Barbara Day, and this is the news for Sunday, May 1st, 2005. President Bush on Saturday defended his plan to cut the growth of some retirement benefits, saying it will fix most of Social Security's financing problems while helping people most in need. Democrats have harshly criticized the proposal, which the president unveiled Thursday as part of a 60-day campaign to push an overhaul of the Social Security program. Bush's plan would link the growth in benefits for some retirees to inflation rather than faster-growing wages. Bush says under this plan, wealthier people would see their future benefits curbed, while most middle-income people would see limits on benefits, but not as much, the president said. The proposal to curb benefits is part of a broader plan in which Bush would also allow younger workers to shift some of their Social Security payroll taxes into private stock and bond accounts. Polls show the public is wary that the idea has of that idea and has grown even more so over the course of Bush's two-month Social Security tour. The president has warned that the program is headed for bankruptcy when Social Security trust funds run out in 2041. The president said cuts in benefit will not affect low-income people.
You're listening to the news on WBAI New York. Today, May Day, is also known throughout the world as International Workers' Day. Throughout the nation and the world, people came out to celebrate May Day and focus on the problems of workers in this age of globalization and free trade zones. Here in New York City, hundreds crowded into Union Square Park for a rally demanding fair rights for poor and working class people around the nation. As for the president's Social Security plan, most speakers expressed anger and the need to fight back. Union leader Brenda Stokely is president of ASME 1707.
This is another example of us reclaiming what's in our interest. So we are reclaiming our day, not the picnic on Labor Day. Also, I think it represents a resurgence in terms of a more progressive revolutionary tendency within the labor movement that is not about selling out the workers, in terms of sellout contracts, in terms of trying to demoralize them and tell them that they cannot fight back. There's also a unity between workers, whether they're organized or not organized, whether they're women or men, whether whatever industry they're in, and whether they're unemployed or they're working, whether they're immigrant workers or the people of color or white workers. And that's very important because the ruling class has tried to divide us every which way is up. And that has kept us separate and it has kept us powerless. So now we're coming together and we're reasserting that a united working class is going to be the solution to many of the problems here in this country.
Sarah Flounders from the Troops Out Now Coalition.
Union Square is for decades and generations where working people have come together to assert renewed determination to struggle for their rights and to fight against cutbacks, and it's needed now more than ever. So we see today as a real step in that unity, and we're very excited about this. And it's so interesting that in Union Square, now even a decade ago, most of the big department stores that used to be here had union workers. And you look at it today, and whether it's Virgin Records or Garden of Eden or Whole Foods, the shop after shop, food or service industry around here is now non-union, low-paid workers without any benefits, without health care, without pensions. And so bringing that message back to Union Square and recalling those past struggles is today important, and yet knowing it also also their huge rally, of course, in Havana, Cuba, a million strong as it is year after year, and in Venezuela, and it's true throughout Latin America, it's true in Africa, in Asia. In Europe today, most of the May Day demonstrations are calling for immigrant rights and an end to the racist attacks on immigrant workers, and it's really reflected back here.
Teresa Gutierrez, the New York Committee to Free the Cuban Five. The anti-war movement's decision to revive May Day is very important. This is a day when millions of people around the world march for worker and people's rights, so it's very fitting that the struggle for May Day be revived in the United States, because it's here, this government, that creates such havoc for billions of workers. And it's especially important to raise the issue of the free trade agreement, especially in the context of Cuba, because 2 weeks ago, the Bush administration told labor and other activists that they could not travel to Cuba to participate in the FTA conference in Havana last week. This is a broad international gathering that has implications for everyone, including workers here in the U.S.
Nellie Bailey of the Harlem Tenants Council, and what a great turnout here in Union Square today.
Yes, the turnout is great. But what's even better is the spirit of the people. And this is evidence more than anything else that May Day is here to stay, and bringing it back at this crucial and historic time, particularly when workers are under assault across the nation, is very, very important.
What are your comments about Mr. Bush's speech earlier this week, particularly as it relates to Social Security?
The president's plan to privatize Social Security in a way, number one, that will reduce benefits, because that's what he announced this past week, which is shocking in and of itself. In addition to their plans not to overhaul Social Security, but in fact to eliminate Social Security, because I think it's very clear that that is what they are working towards, and that is the elimination of Social Security.
The 2005 May Day call, signed by labor, community, and movement leaders and organizers, included a call for the rebirth of worldwide solidarity.
And this is the news on WBAI New York. Reports from Tokyo indicate that North Korea may have launched a short-range missile into the Sea of Japan today. According to Japanese media, the missile, with a range of about 60 miles, was of very short range and posed no danger to Japan. Washington has accused North Korea of trying to be, quote, bullies of the world. White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card told reporters the North Koreans have tested missiles before.
Demanding an end to nuclear weapons and the renewal of nuclear weapons non-proliferation treaty, today 30 to 40,000 people took to the streets of Manhattan marching to Central Park. The review conference for the treaty will be held for a month starting Monday, with the Bush administration having already announced its intentions to make drastic changes to accommodate its new arsenal of weapons. International representatives from dozens of countries marched along with more than 1,000 Japanese and 100 hibakushas, or survivors of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. WBAI's Fred Nguyen was on 42nd Street, the march route, where he gauged the marchers' mood.
There's about 100 of us from all over the world. We actually represent 942 cities in 111 countries. We are a group of elected representatives, and what we're trying to do is say to governments, you are not representing the people we are, and we want an end to nuclear weapons.
Are you a council person?
I'm on the Council for London, yes, the London Assembly it's called. The Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, has actually made a statement. He has made London a signatory to Mayors for Peace and feels very strongly about it. He's been a supporter of CND, our campaign for nuclear disarmament, for many, many years.
Is the fight against nuclear weapons a big thing in the United Kingdom?
We're in a general election over there. The government's actually having quite a tough time. First of all, about the war in Iraq that we feel was illegal, but also about the nuclear issue. And quite honestly, we've had a treaty now for 35 years, the Treaty for Non-Proliferation, and we still haven't taken the first step, which is actually just to start to get rid of the weapons. It's all words. We want some action.
have come to attend the NPT Review Conference. We are 60 French people here.
What is the position of France regarding this treaty?
France says that it respects the treaty, but it's not completely true because France forgets one of the three pillars of the NPT, which is disarmament, and focuses on non-proliferation. The treaty says that all the countries have to make commitments to achieve nuclear disarmament. And since France still have nuclear weapons, it doesn't make steps to achieve disarmament.
Is there a lot of debate in France about what the Americans are doing in terms of nuclear weapons, like the bunker buster bombs and things like that? Are they talking about that?
No, they don't. People don't feel concerned. People think that nuclear weapons are outdated because the Cold War is over. So it doesn't matter if we do have or don't have them. But it's different from the rest of the world, who sees that we have them and we forbid others to have them, and that's unfair.
You're from Veterans for Peace.
I'm also a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
The war in Vietnam ended
30 years ago. I thought we learned our lesson back then, 30 years ago, that we can't go with other countries and enforce our will. Apparently we didn't learn our lesson. Now we're in Iraq doing the same thing all over again, and eventually it's going to be the same result. You know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over again, expecting different results.
What's the analysis of Veterans for Peace about why we're having war again?
Well, it's all money and oil.
And that demonstration is still going on, an estimated 30 to 40,000 people out in the streets, and these are preliminary estimates. And this is the news on WBAI New York. In other news, this evening, reports on the Arabic language news channel Al Arabiya indicate that an Iraqi suicide bomber attacked the headquarters of the Kurdistan Democratic Party in northern Baghdad today. According to the newspaper, about 30 people were wounded in the attack. In recent days, insurgents have carried out a furious sequence of attacks, including more than 15 car bombings in Baghdad that have killed dozens of civilians and soldiers.
Also in Baghdad today, insurgents launched a third straight day of attacks. These include ambushes, car bombs, and a drive-by shooting. 9 Iraqis were killed and 20 wounded. Officials in Baghdad told reporters that the attacks, which took place over the last week following the announcement of a partial Iraqi government, seem to have been well coordinated. The stepped-up violence is a blow to the Bush administration, which had hoped a new government in Baghdad would curb support for the insurgency by including members of the Sunni Arab minority in the new Shia-dominated cabinet that is expected to be sworn in Tuesday.
Meanwhile, most observers believe the minority Sunnis, who held a monopoly on power during Saddam Hussein's rule, are the backbone of Iraq's insurgency. Most Sunnis stayed away from last January's parliamentary elections. Their absence stemmed from fear because coalition forces failed to provide the security needed for them to vote, or others stayed away in protest of the U.S.-led occupation. However, after months of negotiations, the lineup named by incoming Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari excluded Sunnis from any meaningful positions in the cabinet and left the key oil and defense ministries in temporary hands. Approval of the partially formed cabinet last Thursday was followed by an onslaught of bombings in Baghdad and elsewhere. From Washington, Max Pringle reports that last Friday, at least 31 people were killed in attacks.
The apparently coordinated blast came just a day after Prime Minister Ibrahim Jafari unveiled his new cabinet. No one has admitted to carrying out the attacks, the deadliest of which took place in Baghdad's Adamiya area. A tape, purportedly from al-Qaeda's point man in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, calls for more attacks on U.S. forces. Stephen Cook is a Middle East analyst at the Council on Foreign Relations.
There was a sense immediately after the elections that perhaps the insurgency would not find the kind of support that it had previously found amongst the Iraqi populace. But in fact, the number of insurgent attacks are up this year. So it's clear that the elections, although very positive in many ways, have not necessarily taken the wind out of the sails of the insurgency.
Four blasts rocked the Sunni-dominated neighborhood of Adamiya. The bombs went off within minutes of each other and targeted patrols of Iraqi police and National Guard, as well as a restaurant they frequent. A short while later, a bomb exploded as an Iraqi army convoy passed through the east of the city. One soldier was killed and eight wounded. Another bomb went off as people gathered to investigate. Three other devices went off close to a military checkpoint, a hospital, and post office in the town of Medayin, south of Baghdad, killing troops and wounding civilians. And for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle.
You're listening to the news on WBAI New York. Lindy England, the U.S. soldier pictured holding a naked Iraqi detainee on a leash in the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, will plead guilty tomorrow to 7 of 9 charges against her. The 22-year-old reservist will be the 7th low-level guard to plead guilty to abusing prisoners. The more senior officers have been exonerated by the military, despite concern that a high-level Pentagon initiative actually created the atmosphere in which such abuses did occur.
Meanwhile, the conditions of detainees held in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and the detention centers in Afghanistan and Iraq are coming under fire. A new report by a leading human rights group names Donald Rumsfeld and former CIA chief George Tenet and calls for the appointment of a special prosecutor to investigate reports of abusive interrogation techniques.
Today, the Italian government said its own report on the killing of Italian intelligence agent Nicola Calipari at a U.S. military checkpoint will be made public tomorrow. Officials told Reuters the report will provide the government's version of the March 4th friendly fire shooting death of agent Calipari, who had just won the release of journalist Giuliana Segrina. The Pentagon report released Saturday cleared U.S. soldiers of responsibility and recommended no disciplinary action. According to Washington, the car Calipari was riding in as he headed to Baghdad airport with the ex-hostage did not slow down at the checkpoint. The two Italian experts who took part in the investigation refused to sign off on the Pentagon's conclusions.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York, streaming live on the web at www.wbai.org. Britain is in the final countdown to general elections on May 5th. The latest polls indicate that Labour is leading. However, Prime Minister Tony Blair has been dogged by criticism of the Allied invasion of Iraq. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
It's unlikely that Tony Blair's Labour Party will lose this election. It's more a question of how much damage the opposition parties can do to their 160-seat majority in Parliament. But no one opposition party looks able to garner enough votes from an apathetic British public, and no government gets voted out of office when the economy is strong. This is despite the fact that after 2 terms of a new Labour government, even some Labour activists are feeling betrayed and are looking at their options. John Harris is an ex-Labour activist, and he's written prolifically about his disillusionment with the Labour Party.
The war in Iraq is a huge, huge issue for people who've traditionally voted Labour in the past. A, because it was a very strange spectacle to see a Labour Prime Minister in such close allegiance with the most right-wing administration in America in living memory. But also, more importantly, it's caused a huge crisis of trust in this government. It's now accepted by most people, if you look at opinion polls, that a great deal of mendaciousness and deceit went on in the course of our progress towards that war.
The main opposition Conservative Party supported the war in Iraq and is further to the right than New Labour. Their campaign has focused on immigration. Trouble is, while migration into Britain has more than doubled in the last few years, that figure still falls below the 650,000 job vacancies which Britain needs migrant workers to fill. And the Conservatives' plans to abandon the Geneva Convention for receiving refugees prompted swift United Nations condemnation. In Britain's first-past-the-post electoral system, where a vote for the second-largest opposition party, the Liberal Democrats, who opposed the war, may mean letting in the Conservative main opposition through the back door, many voters may feel that's not much of a choice, and only 60% or less of those eligible to vote are expected to vote at all. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
And this is the news on WBAI New York. Back here at home, according to the Justice Department, prison populations across the country continue to grow. While some lawmakers clamor for more prisons to reduce overcrowding, a growing movement of community groups is calling for a rethinking of the nation's whole prison policy. From Washington, Darby Hickey has that story.
94% of prisons and jails in the U.S. are at or over capacity, and the number of people incarcerated around the country increased by about 3.5% annually from 1995 to 2004. That from a new report issued by the Federal Bureau of Justice Statistics, which Paige Harrison helped to author.
There's a lot of things contributing to the continued growth in the prison and jail system. Some of it is that we're bringing more people in than we're releasing. We're keeping them for longer periods of time. And upon release, we have changed some of our release policies as far as parole, type of release, and revocation. So we have more parole violators coming back as well.
Federal rates increased by much more than state incarceration numbers, says Harrison, driven by drug-related offenses. Although the numbers continue to rise, the tide is starting to turn against pro-prison policies, says Zain Alameen, a member of Critical Resistance DC, an organization that opposes prisons.
On the one hand, you have this increase in incarceration, you have cutting back of social services that results in more incarceration. But on the other hand, there are prominent conservatives who are raising an alarm about this increase in incarceration and about the skewed priorities.
Critical Resistance is one of many groups across the country that are mobilizing in communities to stop new prisons and criminalization, which they say disparately impacts people of color. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics report, about 60% of people in prisons and jails are people of color.
And so we know as long as there's prisons, they're going to find a way to put somebody in the prison. So what do we got to do? Shut them down.
Corey Hicks is a member of Families and Friends of Louisiana's Incarcerated Children, or FLIC, another community group that has celebrated organizing victories in the past year.
And that's what we did. We shut down the Tallulah Correctional Facility.
In addition to the over 2 million people incarcerated in prisons and jails, the authors of the report note that another 110,000 juveniles are in detention, but not included in the report.
FLIC with the Juvenile Justice Project of Louisiana was instrumental in the first step in changing what used to be a completely horrific, violent facility, and it's now in the process of being turned into a learning center with a community college at its core. When this happens, this will be the first prison-to-school conversion in the entire nation.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey.
And you're listening to the news on Pacifica Radio New York. In a stunning announcement last week, Sharman Stein, spokesperson for the New York City Administration of Children's Services, or ACS, told reporters that in the last two decades, thousands of Black and Latino babies and children in the care of ACS may have died while being subjected to drug experiments. Yesterday in the rain, more than 200 angry community activists demonstrated in front of the Incarnation Children's Center in Washington Heights. They were demanding its immediate shutdown and full disclosure of what they call the ACS genocide. WBAI's Fred Nguyen was there and filed this report.
Ever since the airing of the documentary named Guinea Pig Kids on the BBC last November, the Black community in New York City has been up in arms. The film denounces the abuse of Black and Latino children taken from addicted mothers or placed in foster care, who were subjected to drug trials for the benefit of GlaxoSmithKline, the second largest pharmaceutical company in the world, which then avoided costly delays in filing for animal experimentation with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Omowale Clay from the December 12 movement speaks about the Incarnation House.
They've taken the sign down, but what this place represents is the historical racism that has affected Black and Latino people in this country. It reflects the worst of what they've been doing to us. Children in this facility were collected from all over this region, allegedly for having HIV, allegedly for having AIDS, allegedly for being under threat of dying. And these children were used for experiments, clinical trials sanctioned by Columbia University, the Catholic Charities, and the New York City Administration for Children's Services, which runs this facility. These children were the victims of drug experiments. Experiments which they say was to help the children heal, but which we know was to test drugs, lethal and toxic drugs, on our Black and Latino babies. This is a crime against humanity.
Roger Warren from the Coalition Against ACS Drug Experiments says that city and state officials are trying to cover up the scandal and are ignoring the evidence of criminal activities at ACS, a secretive agency which, he says, hides its abuses by claiming to protect children's privacy.
We held a press conference in December at ACS. We started having demonstrations here. We sent a letter to the commissioner of ACS, Mattingly, which basically said, how long was this going on? Who was tested? What drugs were administered? Who died? What are the long-term effects of these drugs? And who's responsible for it? We never got a real reply. We met in January with Councilman de Blasio, whose committee is in charge of ACS, asking for a hearing. He said he was satisfied with what they had already provided. He was not going to hold a hearing. We met with ACS legal people and for City's Corporation Council. They had had our letter for a month and a half. They said they'd get back to us. We haven't heard from them yet. Last week, ACS put out a press release. It said they had hired an independent firm to investigate what was happening in ACS, and then they were appointing an independent panel to evaluate the findings of this independent research group that they were paying for. The reason that they're going to have a hearing, the reason that the media is out here, the reason that ACS has now said they're going to investigate it is because of the people who came out here every week from December till the time we found out about it. It's not due to any change of heart by ACS. It's due to the fact that masses of people are now outraged by what is happening and demanding that it stop.
A hearing on the ACS drug trials would be held at City Hall on Thursday, May 5th at 10 a.m. The activists ask that people of conscience take a day off from work to attend and force the city to come clean on the fate of hundreds of defenseless Black and Latino children whose only fault is to be born in poverty in a system only too eager to exploit them. For the WBAI Sunday News, this is Fred Nguyen.
And thank you, Fred, for that. And finally, we conclude our news today on a sad note. Fred Kuhn, our longtime friend and colleague here at WBAI, died early Friday morning. For years, Fred, our receptionist, was the first person visitors to the station saw and spoke with. He hosted his own program, Light Show, and was regarded by many as the station's historian. Fred was here during many of the sometimes tumultuous changes of administration that have taken place at WBAI over the years. Throughout it all, he maintained a great sense of fairness and good humor. The newsroom's Rebecca Miles spoke about Fred with many volunteers and producers at the station, among them acting arts director Janet Coleman.
Fred was a very erudite fellow, but, you know, without a trace of snobbery. You knew from his interests, folk music, Christianity, and wrestling, that he had a very unusual intellect and a very dry wit. He wrote the song, "Father, Forgive Them Not, for They Know Damn Well What They Do." And, of course, he had a beautiful voice, singing and speaking. We are really all grieving him here very, very hard. He was a very gentle, gentle, sweet soul, Fred.
And that was WBAI's acting arts director, Janet Coleman. We will miss Fred, and in his inimitable words, stay tuned.
And that's some of the news for Sunday, May 1st, 2005. The news was produced and engineered with Fred Nguyen, Sean Rhodes, and T-Dub. With Sally O'Brien, I'm Barbara Day for the WBAI listener-supported news, asking that you stay tuned for a May Day special hosted by WBAI's Building Bridges.